The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. And joining us today on Campus Voices is a return guest, Victor Perez, an assistant professor in sociology here at the university. He's an expert in tenor saxophonist John Coltrane's late period, and we might have to have a discussion of that sometime on WVD's Music Room. But for today, we're going to discuss another topic in which Professor Perez is an expert, the interaction between science and societies. Victor studies the feedback loop between science and society, science and the society in which it happens, sort of the cutting edge of public health. And last year, we talked about claims of cancer clusters, both real and alleged, as a way of talking about what people know about cancer and how they perceive in the areas in which they live. And it's all part of the rhetoric of public health.
Yeah, thanks, Rich. I'm glad to be back on. The cancer cluster work is related to this, the rhetorical dimensions of that in particular, but I'm interested mostly in the public health and medicine kind of side of science, and the way that that ideas of public health, the science of public health, the science of medicine are disseminated in the media, the newspaper, in particular right now, the internet. I've been studying a lot. And in both disseminating results of studies, people's interpretations of studies. And one of the ways that I'm really particularly interested in how that reaches the public is when the public responds with their own anecdotal stories that are germane to the public health topic, be it autism or vaccines or certain types of diets or the environment and toxins and so forth. And so that's really the intersection of science and society that I'm interested in.
So it's more about the relationship between popular beliefs and certain health issues. And I think it's funny, we're going to start by looking at some examples of what you call anti-science rhetoric, and then then we'll move on into talking about how some discoveries have made their started making their way into Howie Mandel and the rest of popular culture.
Right, and The View and other shows like that.
So what are some of the examples of the anti-science rhetoric that have caught your attention?
What's interesting is that, you know, as a sociologist, I'm interested in a variety of different topics, such as, you know, creationism or the anti-vaccine movements, and trying to link them all together theoretically. More or less as topics or as case studies. I see that as one of my roles is really trying to find an explanation, theoretical perspective that can help to inform a variety of these sorts of topics because they all have similarities. For example, you can see in the anti-vaccine movement, the way that it works online is often by a variety of websites that are created by either parents of children with autism or other sorts of organizations that tend to have an anti-vaccine or as they might say, a vaccine critical or a pro-vaccine safety approach.
I'm a child of the 50s and the 60s where vaccines were a really big deal. I mean, in a good way.
Yeah.
I mean, that polio vaccine, that was such a big deal
for
all of us kids in the early 1950s.
Well, vaccines are arguably one of the greatest, you know, benefits to public health in modern history. And, you know, it's pretty interesting because there is a very prominent area online of anti-vaccine rhetoric. And as I was saying earlier, generally it comes about from people who either feel victimized, that maybe their child was medically harmed, or you'll see there's actually burgeoning explanations for anti-vaccine rhetoric online that suggest it's really about the politicization of science. And we all know that science has political dimensions, who gets funded and how and so what types of studies and so forth. And that's not really what this means. The politicization of science means really kind of the reaction to the scientific enterprise and the data and the results and the things that are coming out of the scientific method. So one of the things, for example, that people are beginning to find in different forms of research is that the conservative kind of wing of politics has actually shown over time a pretty steep decrease in their trust in science relative to other political groups like liberals and moderates and so forth. Liberals, you know, generally having the most trust in science. There's a journal in the world of sociology, which is called the American Sociological Review, and it is the flagship in terms of prestige and so forth of the professional sociology. Very difficult to get published. The peer review process is very thorough. And there's a great article that came out about 2 years ago where a sociologist was talking about this. And to summarize his main empirical findings, his study shows that public trust in science has not declined since the 1970s, except among conservatives and those who frequently attend church. And his analysis provides negligible evidence for what he called cultural ascendancy thesis, which suggests that trust in science will increase over time. So really, we're seeing a politicization. And to come full circle to answer your question, you'll also find conservatives also tend to trust the things like evolution and climate change and the science behind those things much less so than other political groups as well.
It's interesting you're saying all that because I get caught at my cult meeting about 50 Sundays a year. You know, I go to church regularly,
yeah.
And I'm a great believer in the scientific method, and that is a method of getting to know how the world works, how we can make the world better for people, and that kind of thing. So I think that's fascinating.
It is. And in a lot of ways, the politicization explanation is very good because, again, it explains a host of different things. It explains a reaction to the science of evolution. It explains a reaction to the science of climate change. It explains a reaction to anti-vaccine as well. It really has nothing to do with education. You'll find that people with high levels of education who are more conservative will tend to have less trust in science. And some of the explanations for that are coming out of the literature, coming out of the research, suggest it has to do with issues such as civil liberties. So, for example, the notion of big government being able to intervene and address climate change by putting restrictions on different sorts of fossil fuel use and so forth, or telling you to get your kid vaccinated before you can take him to school. Some conservatives' reaction to that might be the underlying basis.
It's just one of those things. They don't want the government telling them what to do in their personal life.
That's certainly the civil liberties argument certainly would suggest that. And so how that's manifested is in a distrust of the larger institution of government, but also what conservatives might see or call as, you know, scientists who get all this money from the government and are, you know, paid and by the government, so on and so forth. And so there's a distrust in the enterprise of science because of there's a distrust in the scientists who are being funded by the government, who they might feel are impeding on their civil liberties and introducing policy that may interrupt their profit from different sorts of enterprises they have that may or may not contribute to climate change and so forth. And so and I think that the religious side of that, of conservatism, is also obviously something that contributes to the anti-evolution and the pro-creationism sort of stance. But, you know, the politicization of it is interesting in how it manifests itself and its reaction to the legitimacy and authority of science. It's almost like it immediately washes it all away just because of the issues that we've been talking about, as if there was no rigor or anything behind hundreds of studies that were done. It's pretty fascinating.
One of the things that when we met a few weeks ago, you told me is that a lot of these anti-science rhetoricians quote each other and build this whole loop of, oh, but he said it, and all these different people are saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the ways that they reinforce their arguments with each other, is they say, look, I found 97 web resources mm-hmm. that say that the measles vaccine leads to autism.
The internet has become one of the main mechanisms for the validation of alternative views of science. And even if there's study after study, be they epidemiological or experimental or what have you, in the public health and medicine era, and field, the presence of websites that are opposed to that sort of information, that sort of method, and so forth, is formidable. And I actually published a study that I did in an edited book for undergraduates on social problems a couple of years ago that examined a handful, roughly a dozen or so websites that are, they might refer to themselves as vaccine critical. And essentially what they do is at any kind of point of entry, you might say, any one of these websites that you might enter, it could be 3 a.m. and, you know, you're having some issues with your child or something, you're bouncing around the web, and one of these serves as a portal, They will then bounce you around via a series of interconnected web links to more or less an inclusive kind of hub or network of sites, and that.
But they all link to each other.
They all link to each other, and they all reinforce each other's views for the most part. So you'll find anecdotal evidence from parents across these different websites, for example. And you know, that's profound, because the idea of explaining autism, one, is extremely difficult, but two, the idea of science is not warm and close and fuzzy. It's distant, and it's cold and calculating. And when you're reading parents' experiences online, and you're able to say whether or not you're you know, remembering in a way that you're attuning your memories to what you're reading now. Or not, but you're starting to read all these other parents' stories, and you're like, you know, that happened to me. And that happened to 50 other people on the site. Oh my gosh, it happened to 100 on those sites? This can't be a coincidence. There has to be a relationship between my kid getting the MMR vaccine and developing autism, regressive autism later on. So, you know, when you're insulated in that sort of bubble, and there are very few hyperlinks taking you out to sites with scientific information that negates your anecdotal personal experiences, it's very convincing, and it's almost another form of knowledge that is in opposition, really, to the vast majority of scientific information about at least vaccines.
Sounds like they're self brainwashing themselves. I mean, it's they're going and reading only those things with which they're going to agree. Mm. I mean, we know, and even our intern Sarah knows, that if you're going to do research, you have to look at both sides of an issue, and then.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because in another study that I did, it actually looked at the title of the study is the kind of the rhetorical dimensions of statistics and scientific evidence in the autism epidemic. A handful of years ago, the term epidemic was being used quite liberally across a variety of venues for claims making in social problems process. Well, one of the things that I found that was really interesting is that I found the scientific method itself was really the focal point for a lot of the arguments between the pro and anti-vaccine or vaccine critical group. The focal point of this, the actual idea of scientific inquiry and scientific evidence, is at the center of the debate, where major principles of the scientific method are being used to challenge one another's findings and alternative sources of evidence are being espoused. From critiquing published articles, research methodology, sample sizes, data sources, and conflicts of interest of scientists and authors, as well as emphasizing the importance of peer review and the scientific credentials of researchers, most fundamental aspects of the scientific method are being used by more or less two camps to challenge each other. Those that posit some causal link between medical interventions and i.e. vaccines and autism, and those that do not. And so in a way, the scientific method is being used to critique each other. And I found that a truly fascinating issue in kind of the public knowledge of, you know, vaccines and quote-unquote vaccine-induced harm is that the same principles of the scientific method that allow for us to get good, credible, valid information about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines is also being contorted in a way to respond to say, you know, no, actually vaccines are full of toxins and they're harmful and so forth. It is really interesting how science and the scientific method is being delegitimized, legitimized. It's being used on both sides, if you will, both camps. And so much of this is possible because of the public access to this information. You know, the web is you know, at least theoretically democratizing, in that anybody who wants to read any federally funded study, for example, can go ahead and read it. If the feds gave you money and you are with any organization and you did a study in public health manner, that's freely available. And so having access to these studies is really important, because there's other research that actually suggests, pretty good research methodologically, that suggests that people who were more or less evaluated in terms of their degree or level of, affiliation with anti-vaccine notions, either being called, you know, heavily anti-vaccine or pro-vaccine, people were evaluated for their attitude towards vaccines. And then they were shown a variety of different pieces of scientific evidence. And what was interesting is that the people who scored the highest in terms of being anti-vaccine could never be convinced. They could never be convinced, regardless of how much evidence they were shown. There was always some way to kind of respond to that evidence. And so it was really fascinating. And you know, famously, Bill Nye, when he most recently was debating the creationism stuff, says, show me the evidence. If you show me the evidence, I'll believe in creationism. Just show me the evidence, you know. And so what's interesting is that a scientist ordinarily is open to kind of progression of their ideas and reinterpretation and reevaluation of their ideas. But for one reason or another, the people who are generally seen as either more conservative or strongly anti-vaccine and so forth, regardless of the evidence, they're never convinced. Some of the research is suggesting. There are studies now coming out evaluating the presence of anti-vaccine rhetoric online. And I mean, there are hundreds of sites, but there are probably several, maybe three or four dozen very prominent sites that are well-funded and by users, you know, more or less propagating information that that isn't credible, at least by scientific standards.
We're talking today with Professor Victor Perez from the University of Delaware Sociology Department. We're talking about some of the issues surrounding science and science rhetoric, and we've been talking a lot about the debate about vaccines, but one of the things that has started to appear is we're starting to see pockets of these diseases springing up.
Yeah, there are a few studies that have shown in areas where vaccine uptake is either opted out of completely or certain vaccines are delayed and so forth. You know, the way that disease works and the way that people catch diseases and so forth is pretty complicated. And so you might hear the terms like herd immunity and things of that nature, and why should I get my kid vaccinated if, you know, there's herd immunity and so forth. And there's a lot of reasons, but namely, there are some people who can't get vaccines because their immune system doesn't allow for it, and so those people are susceptible to diseases. Their migration patterns, your kid could have something and take it somewhere, somebody can, you know, be on an airplane, et cetera. So you'll find in some pockets, I think there was evidence in California and a few other places where there are outbreaks of diseases in childhood, such as whooping cough, pertussis, and a few others that we haven't seen. And we're talking about outbreaks of like a few hundred people. So it's not like we're looking at, you know, the plague or anything here. But in terms of what we were able to kind of reduce these numbers to, then yes, they're significant in their rise. Partly also the idea that vaccines are partly effective, or that they may or may not wear off as you get older and need, you know, boosters and so forth, can have something to do with it as well. But there is credible evidence that opting out of certain vaccines or delaying them is also causing an uptake in some of these childhood preventable childhood diseases.
So we've got people who are really bringing their either pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine prejudices to look at the evidence and aren't really looking at the other side that much.
It's almost like they're predisposed and having a particular attitude towards it. And that's really why I think the politicization thesis is pretty good, because, you know, that's an attitude that you bring with you as an adult, at least when you're talking about being the gatekeeper for what happens to your kid in terms of medical interventions, at least. And so in a lot of ways, you bring those biases and those attitudes with you that influence ultimately your behavior. And again, you know, the presence of this stuff online, the information, both pro and anti-vaccine, for example, there's a number of sites that you can look at. The CDC, for example, has vaccine information through it. The National Network for Immunization Information is also a credible source for vaccinations and so forth. And then there's an organization called the National Vaccine Information Center, which when you go to the website, it looks exactly like almost the CDC or the National Network for Immunization Information. And the National Vaccine Information Center, though, is a pretty well-known vaccine critical, if you will, website that says, you know, what are the vaccine laws and exemptions in your state? Here you go. If you are going to vaccinate, make sure you ask these questions about vaccination first. Protect your rights, personal rights in Washington. What are the vaccine ingredients calculators? How high, you know, are the toxins and so on and so forth? So, you know, the rhetorical dimensions are really important, like the idea of toxins being in vaccines, being one of the reasons why people in homeopathy or alternative medicine may or may not be involved in getting their kids vaccinated, because there's this idea that they're toxic, and that's a really popular idea, and it's not supported by science. It comes from certain ingredients in the vaccines that are either preservatives or some sort of, you know, kind of ingredient that allows it to be effective. And so people say, well, you're injecting, you know, aluminum into your baby. Well, I mean, if you say that, then, you know, it has a really profound effect. But what really is happening is the question we got to ask. Okay, well, what's in the vaccine? So on, what are the effects? So on and so forth. That was one of the big ones here, at least in the U.S., with thinking about certain vaccines having a preservative called thimerosal, which is ethyl mercury. And so people say you're injecting your kid with mercury, you know. And so it has the statements like that are powerful, and you'll find them online.
It's about the rhetoric. It's about the rhetoric, my brother.
No. Yeah, and right now scientists are in a position where they have to, which is somewhat unprecedented. You know, they feel like they're in a fist fight at this point, and they have to defend themselves. Where the scientific method didn't have to defend itself before, and now it's got to defend itself in some very important public health issues.
You said fist fight. Let's transition from there to some of the popular issues that are coming out of the scientific community.
Okay.
I remember when Howie Mandel was thought of as a weirdo because he wouldn't shake hands with people. He'd only...
fist bump, yeah. I think Obama's taking that on, too. At least I heard that in passing, but yeah.
But where did that come from?
Actually, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up because the dissemination of scientific knowledge in the public media is profound. And I mean, the internet is by far, in my opinion, the place for this. And it comes from a variety of sites, things like NPR, for example. NPR, Slate, Wired, all of these, The Atlantic, all of these things that you can go online, find on social media, they're either themselves scientific outlets or they are journalist outlets who write about science. So these are science writers that are accessible online now through Facebook or whatever the actual website itself. Whereas in the past, you know, you had to go grab Scientific American and read it, you know. But nowadays, you can just be bouncing around on NPR and you'll see an article about a new recipe or a new juice diet fad or why you know, coconut water actually is not as good as just drinking regular water to hydrate you and so forth. But the fist bump actually was on NPR, came out of NPR Health. It's interesting because there were scientists in Wales who published in the American Journal of Infection Control. And what's interesting, this is a study that I think had 5 people in it. But what they did is they looked at how germs were spread when people more or less interact in a way that's customary by either shaking hands or high-fiving or whatever. And they basically found that the firm handshake that your grandfather taught you, to paraphrase the website, actually transmits, you know, the vast majority of bacteria and so forth relative to other sorts of customary ways of interacting with people, such as a light handshake or a high five. And they found that the fist bump actually transmits the fewest number of germs and bacteria. And it has to do with duration and the amount of surface.
Surface area contact.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, it's interesting because I had heard, I don't know how true this is, but I had heard that that the handshake originated as a way to introduce yourself as well as to say hello, because it showed that you were not concealing any kind of weapon.
That's correct. And you use your right hand,
yeah,
because most people were right-handed.
Yeah.
So I don't have a sword in my right hand. I'm shaking my right hand with you.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is to think, well, maybe this article also gets at is how the dissemination of scientific knowledge in the public media may actually be able to also change culture. And so perhaps, you know, in 50 years, we'll all be fist bumping as opposed to shaking hands. And if you shake hands, you might be, you know, stigmatized or like, oh, what are you doing? You don't shake hands, you know, fist bump, you know, something like that. So the possibilities of it having influence on popular cultures is interesting, too.
You know, another little minor thing that I used to think was hilarious when I first heard about it was this whole business of sneeze into your elbow or cough into your elbow. Because, I mean, I was raised, you know, right into your hands.
Yeah. That's the way, generally speaking, that public health maintenance was at least for, you know, small things like that in public and what's customary was passed on. You know, it's just custom. You could probably, I mean, anyone listening to this radio show knows now, but you might ask somebody just run of the mill, hey, you know, why do we shake hands? Nobody probably knows, you know, and so eventually maybe, you know, people might not know why we fist bump. But if it takes off, it's actually because you'll get fewer colds and fewer infections and fewer warts and whatever else all over your hands.
Let's talk for a minute about diets, because
sure,
that is just an absolute cesspool of competing myths, if you will.
You know, the diet stuff is interesting because you find interactions there with a variety of things that we've been talking about, the rhetorical dimensions of health information and so forth. But there's something there that's also, and this comes up in the anti-vaccine rhetoric as well. It's not exactly true, but it has to do with profit and business. The diet and the juicing industries are unabashedly moneymakers. And so you'll find these things actually being interesting kind of cultural outgrowths of efforts to market a particular diet or juice cleanse or detox or what have you as its lifestyle. Because the scientific evidence doesn't support any of these things, the vast majority of them. For example, recently the juice cleanse has been very popular in terms of people wanting to cleanse, you know, by just drinking juices and so forth. Well, the idea of cleansing, for one, is a myth by way of food, at least. You can eat well or you cannot eat well, but the idea of eating food and cleansing your body with it is actually not supported by any scientific evidence. What cleanses your body is your liver and your kidneys. There's no food that does a better job of it than those things. And so, you know, the terminology itself is powerful because it promotes a lifestyle. You know, I'm cleansing my body. And the idea of juicing to do that, some people might suggest that, you know, they feel better after they juice, they lose weight, so on and so forth. And that's probably because they cut their calorie intake in half. So, yeah, there's a couple of good studies that you can put up. There's a great video from The Atlantic, which does a pretty good job of reporting on science and health issues. But there's a couple of good studies that you can talk about. That you can post online that we can talk about. There's a study from a couple of years ago that came out of The Salt from NPR, which is mostly about food, but it's also got some health things. But it talked about whether or not a diet can clean out your toxins in the body. And they say, and I'll quote Eliza Barkley from NPR, "Experts say specialized diets won't help rid the body of toxins any more than what the liver and kidneys already do every day." So, you know, you can eat well and feel good, or you cannot. But the idea of kind of cleansing your body is a myth. It's the terminology, and it's sold to you. You know, the juice cleanse and so on and so forth. It's culture and lifestyle. It's not really based on any kind of credible scientific evidence. Same with coconut water, which I've found really interesting, because if anybody's walked through a 7-Eleven or a Whole Foods or an Acme or anything like that recently, you'll see tons of it. But you'll find them everywhere. And, you know, the thing you have to realize here is that they might come and say, you know, an 8 or a 10 or a 12-ounce drink, right? And the scientific evidence shows, and they suggest that they're better to hydrate you, right? That's the suggestion on these coconut water packaging. And so it's better at hydrating you. And the scientific evidence shows that it is not better at hydrating you any better than water is, right? And it actually has either more or fewer levels of certain types of
electrolytes.
Yeah, like it has different levels of, for example, coconut water is low in calories, rich in potassium, and fat and cholesterol free. But the evidence that is actually better than plain water for simple hydration is lacking. And that comes from a study that was a column from Forbes.com. Written by Robert Glattner, MD. And so, you know, the idea that it's better at hydrating you than water is actually not true. And because you're buying it in these smaller amounts, there's a suggestion that you're actually going to be drinking less. And so you're going to be actually less hydrated than you would have been if you just, you know, pounded a big glass of water. You buy the you know, the prescribed size of coconut water, and it's not any better for you than water, so you actually consume less and are hydrated, or you're more dehydrated as a result. And remember what you paid for that coconut water too. it's not cheap. You know, back to the point here, you know, the coconut water is, again, it's marketing, it's culture, it's lifestyle, and its effects are important because remember they're making claims about its effects on your body that is supposed to be the selling point. And really behind all that is profit and ideas about lifestyle and health.
Victor, this has, as always, been great. Victor
Thanks.
Perez from Sociology, thanks for coming to Campus Voices.
Thanks, Rich. I always have a good time. Thanks. And thanks to the intern, too. She was great.
Sarah's great.
Sarah's awesome. Wait, can you grab us a couple of coconut waters?
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1 Newark, or online at wvud.org.